Welcome to News at 11. I'm Wayne McInhopple. Our top story. A few months ago, we played to you a mysterious recording related to the purported disappearance of a 49-year-old man who is now confirmed to be Bat Segundo, the host of a literary radio program that is now in serious jeopardy. Here is the clip again.
Not tonight, my man!
Grim audio, to be sure. However, a new recording has cropped up that places these events into a new light, suggesting that Mr. Segundo is not, in fact, dead. The following audio clip was recorded in East L.A.
Who is it?
It's me, Bat. Open up. I've got the stuff.
Who?
Bat, open up the door. I think they saw me.
Bat?
Bat, goddammit, open up the door. Open up the door, please, please, please.
Go away! Bat's not here!
Police have confirmed that the voice prints on the two recordings do indeed match up, but remain unclear about what the purported stuff might be. We turn now to Mike Edison, who has more information on these shocking developments. Okay, so I am here with Mike Edison, who is the author of I Have Fun Everywhere I Go. Mike, how are you doing?
A-okay. It's a nice day in the neighborhood.
It is a nice day in the neighborhood. First off, you have a lot of critical things to say in this book about a lot of people. I mean, there isn't a chapter.
Brother.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot of shit talking going on. I'm wondering if this
you
book
think?
Was written out of revenge or what?
Absolutely not. I mean, you know, I feel sorry for the people who weren't nice to me in the last 20 years of my career. But no, I didn't. This was not written from a point of view of malice, and that's no place to write a book from. The book's a celebration, and of course, a few people crossed me over the years, and I do kind of take joy in sticking pins in them now.
Yeah,
I'd be lying if I didn't say that there weren't. But success is the best revenge, and history is written by the winners.
You consider yourself a success? You're writing your own history here? Or is this
I'm on your radio show. I think there's no greater sign of success than that.
Fair enough. Well, let's talk about some of the people who you.
Well, yeah,
you
let's
have gone
let's talk about them because I am proud that I didn't pull any punches.
Yeah.
I'm proud to name names.
Okay, okay.
And a mule team of lawyers went through this book.
Actually, forget that question. Tell me about this.
The legal vetting
the
process.
The legal vetting process.
I'll tell you, the day Evel Knievel died was a good day for my lawyers anyway, because he was on the list of potential litigants. You know,
potential litigants, how many names were on that list?
How many pages are in the book?
Were there things that were taken out because of this vetting? Or
no, no one ever asked me to censor the book or take anything out. A couple of times I was asked to rephrase things, and we had a tacit agreement all along that discretion being the better part of valor, that I would change names where apropos. People who were public, especially the public potheads at a High Times magazine where I was the publisher. If you're on the internet smoking dope, if you got you're walking down Broadway with a bong duct taped to your head, you're fair game. But certain people, for instance, the accountant and some of the people in the back,
the marketing witch,
the marketing witch. She's not a public persona, you know, not a nice person, but not public. So hopefully she'll get the message loud and clear. But
were any of the details changed in any way?
Absolutely not. In no way, shape, or form did I fabricate or fabulize any of this. I don't need
no
to.
No composite characters or anything.
No composite characters. I did I compressed the chronology a little bit occasionally. I may have stretched a point for a laugh. You know, I come from a school of professional wrestling and punk rock, and I'm prone to hyperbole, but I guarantee it's all true. In fact, there are some parts I left out because I didn't think people would believe me.
Well, okay. Well, to talk about some of the figures, I wanted to ask, first of all, about some of the harsh words you have for Hebe editor Josh Newman. You write that he did not encourage creativity and became married to every idea he had. You quibble with his photo spread of the Holy Virgin Mother with pierced tits.
That's right. Well,
and you also, though, simultaneously celebrate screw art director Kevin Hine, writing, "Tell the man that this was the week we were going to turn Tom Cruise's narrow white ass into a Hollywood dick depot or strap a dildo on Hillary Clinton and bung it up the rump of the Republican du jour, and he would take to it like Chief Wiggin to a jelly donut." Now, I'm wondering what the distinction is here between these two gentlemen, because a rather non-discerning individual could say, well, you know, Tom Cruise's ass, Holy Virgin Mother, it's all pretty much the same. What's the scenario?
The difference
here
between Kevin and Josh is one of them is talented. One of them is funny. One of them has a sense of irony. One of them is doing it for all the right reasons. I'll tell you, with Keeb, our thing was, you know, I said, we would have been fine to attack the Pope. We would have been to attack intolerance. I have a zero tolerance policy for intolerance. And if he wanted to strap down the Pope and shove a marble rye up his ass, or have him filleted by Woody Allen, or, you know, have Jerry Seinfeld take a shit on his head, that would have been A-OK with me. But to go after the Holy Virgin Mother, that seemed to be attacking somebody's faith. It wasn't ironic. It didn't make any sense. It was like kids playing in a sandbox, just trying to be edgy for the sake of being edgy.
Yeah.
And you got to understand the context, too, was that this was a reaction to the Mel Gibson movie Passion of the Christ, which no one had actually seen at the time. Okay, so we're skirting very dangerously close to mob rules and gang mentality here, the very thing which the magazine should be standing against. Okay, I've got no problem with Jesus. Like I say, I think his message sounded pretty good to me. Kindness to strangers. He stood up for lepers and whores. He turned water into wine. But blaming him for his fans, the moral majority, the Ku Klux Klan, the people who brought us the Spanish Inquisition and Miracle Whip, would be like blaming Jerry Garcia for having fans who smell bad.
Yes, but you clearly haven't heard of the Church of Tom Cruise. Yeah. I mean, there are followers there. They look to that man as, and the Church of Scientology as well.
Well, we don't worship at the altar of hollow celebrity idols. And, you know, and Tom Cruise has crossed the line of all decency and taste.
But he doesn't worship the altar of celebrity that, you know, the Holy Virgin Mother may have, too.
She's a celebrity for probably all the right reasons. Like I said, attacking faith is not a place I ever wanted to come from, especially as a Jewish culture magazine. It just made absolutely no sense. Of course, you know, he got his wrist slapped by the Anti-Defamation League, admittedly not people known for their sense of humor, but it wasn't funny. If it was funny, he would have had me. And all I saw was this sort of ham-fisted attack on someone's faith. It had nothing to do with Mel Gibson's anti-Semitism, which, let me tell you, is palpable. I mean, I went out and saw the movie the first day it's out, and it's like this close to being a snuff film with the Jews being the bad guys. I mean, anything they decide to say about it is absolutely true. The Jews are portrayed horribly in that movie. But first of all, he didn't even see the goddamn thing, which is like Rudolph Giuliani wanting to close the Brooklyn Museum for a painting he never even saw. You know, we don't play that game.
Well, then what are the ground rules for satire, or what distinguishes Tom Cruise from the Holy Virgin Mother? I mean, taking aside the religious component, taking aside the faith component, you know, if you're talking about, like, you know, if you're talking about Tom Cruise's ass as a dick depot, for God's sakes.
The Church of Celebrity is one that I don't tithe in. And it's, I mean, you keep saying Tom Cruise as if we picked him out, but Madonna was a regular. We battered Katie Couric and the cast and stars of American Idol, Charlton Heston. Anybody who was on the front page of the New York Post, the front page of the Inquirer was fair game. And not that we always attacked everybody. Oddly, we came out and supported Martha Stewart because we thought she got shafted, because a non-celebrity, a non-woman never would have done time. If that was a non-famous man, she never would have done time for what she did. I mean, she's guilty, but she got shafted, and people were surprised when we came out in favor of her.
But one might also make the same case for Josh here, because he hasn't always gone after the Holy Virgin Mother. I mean, I guess what is the distinction here?
This is pretzel logic, man. Because what broke it down was very specifically over the Holy Virgin Mother. The other things I have to say about Josh is that I was very disappointed when it came to working with him, because I loved Hebe magazine very much, and I was one of the principals. I came on right at the beginning, I guess the second issue I came on, under Jennifer Blyer, who I adore, and I love Jennifer, and I respect her very much, and she was a great leader, and mainly because she never acted like one. And people flocked to her because, I mean, she was a bit of a starry-eyed idealist and a bit of a hippie, but charming and brutally smart. And she got the idea that you couldn't hit things on the nose. You had to come in sideways. And that was her approach to doing a Jewish pop culture magazine. At the end of the day, I mean, her idea of satire was a Joe Lieberman cutout doll panel with a dress-up kit, so you can make him a nurse, you can make him a Swedish enema bondage girl. I thought that was very funny. It had to do with, like, you know, wolves in sheep's clothing and politicians, and here's this, you know, Jewish Democrat is a real hawk and is just a Republican, and he could dress him up like the Holy Virgin Mother if you wanted to.
Yeah.
And I thought that was very funny. It was clever, and it went, you know, it was more than an inch deep.
Yeah.
What, you know, Josh was doing, I mean, he was just like hitting it right on the nose. And what I said, you know, got married to every idea that he had. I used to have a sign on my door at High Times, and I think I got it from Ad Age, one of the advertising trade magazines, and it's something they teach you in advertising school, and it's throw out your first idea. And it's a real good way to brainstorm, because everyone knows the first idea you get might be the most obvious. And it might, you might come back to it. It might be the best one because it's the most obvious. But if that's where you stop your brainstorming, you get married to every idea you have, I mean, where are you? You're just shutting down creativity. You're really closing the door on some good brain works.
Maybe it's not a matter of being married to the idea. It's a matter of being open to many ideas. Is that sort of what we're talking about here in relation to Josh?
Open to discourse, open to Socratic method, open to other people's ideas, not always having to be the alpha dog, not being a star fucker, all those things.
Okay. Steve Hager does not come out very well in your book either. He was an editor at High Times, and I'm wondering if there's anything good that you can say about the man.
Yeah, and I think I did. I think I was very fair. A good thing about Steve Hager, before he morphed into, you know, a glassy-eyed creep who demanded to be called the Phoenix and ran not so much of a magazine as an autotheocracy, and tried to create a... they call it a cult of personality. You know, as good as was it the Mao Zedong thing? Our friends in Korea.
Great Leap Forward.
Well, you know, I mean, really, I mean, he was this close to like building a statue of himself in the town square. But what he did do was he saved High Times, and I think I'm real open about this. I always give credit where credit is due, you know, and I swing the bat when it needs to be swung. Steve saved the magazine in the early '80s. The magazine was tanking. This was a time when it was rife with cocaine and all sorts of drugs. I mean, there were white powder on the cover, white powder in the centerfold, and it wasn't doing well at all. And he said, let's make this a friendly marijuana cultivation magazine. And he got people who knew how to grow pot in their closets, how to grow pot in their backyards, and how to make stealth gardens of high quality marijuana. And he went out and he grew some pot, and he knew what the hell he was talking about. And it was great. And he really, really turned it around. It was a very positive thing. I think painting everything in rainbow colors may have been right that season. But, you know, fashions change and styles change. And unfortunately, wild horses couldn't have dragged him into the 21st century. But I give him lots of props for really, really bringing High Times into the first modern age.
Well, what then of this High Times Office reality TV show he had last year?
Okay. YouTube is not a reality TV show, okay? There's no barrier to entry, so I don't know what really qualifies. I mean, it's always kind of horrifying when he says to me, oh, we're doing a reality TV show. I'm like, great, NBC, 8 o'clock, right before The Office? And, you know, no, on a computer, you know, near you.
But that would be arguably his effort to grasp the 21st century here, YouTube, I mean.
Yeah, but, you know, I don't think he's making any great progress with that. Steve's a guy who runs a very solipsistic sort of clubhouse. If he doesn't see it, it doesn't exist. And when he got onto this whole video thing, which I think also is a good idea, but he seems to be like firing wide of the audience. It's all about some vision that he has, and it's so inside his brain that I don't think a normal person could comprehend it. I'm real proud of the video that I put up, and I'm not against YouTube, and I'm not against the democracy of the internet. And there are always people who want to watch other people smoke pot on YouTube.
Yeah.
And I'm proof of that. Have you seen that? Have you seen that?
Yeah, I have.
Have you seen that jackass smoking pot out of a guitar? I am that jackass.
Yeah, yeah.
And we put that video up, and I'll tell you what. One thing publishing has taught me is patience. Okay, because it takes months to get the deal signed. It takes a year to write the book. It takes a year to get the book out. And then in 5 minutes, you know, the experience seems to be shot. It's like all day to cook the meal and two seconds to eat it. But one thing I learned is I waited. I held on to that bong guitar for 6 years in my closet.
Yeah.
Just waiting for the time to unfurl it on the American marijuana smoking public. And when it did, it went, through the roof. You know, there were like, you know, 85,000 views in days.
Yeah.
You know, it was all over the place. And I knew it would because it's funny, and it's smart, and it's clever, and it's novel, and it's unique. All the things, unfortunately, that High Times doesn't have going for it, because just smoking pot ain't enough.
Yeah, but on the subject of the Chronicaster, which you tried to get, yeah, I thought it was a fine idea, but you describe Tommy Chong's reluctance to actually play and smoke that guitar in the film, and I have to wonder, were there any efforts to persuade him if you had to sell this? I mean, if this was a vital component of this High Times movie, why did you not just go ahead and say, look, Tommy, we'll devote a whole day in the production schedule just so you can actually play this guitar so you can do this? I mean, here's a guy you're hiring.
for this particular film. I mean, why not actually have him live up to the letter?
Well, there are a few edges to this. And one is that Tommy, realizing that this was a High Times production, thought this movie, and now I'm quoting the writer, the screenplay writer, Vic Colicchio, who was one of the co-writers of Summer of Sam, and he's an actor. You see him on Law and Order all the time. He had a bit part in Goodfellas. He's got a nice role in Bolts on Broadway. He gets killed by Jodie Foster in that last horrible Death Wish movie that she made.
Yeah, the Neil Jordan film, which I'm blanking on the time. I didn't think it was so bad, actually. I thought it was very interesting myself, but...
I prefer Death Wish 4. But anyway, he plays the sleazy John crack-smoking guy who gets killed by it, right? Anyway, that's Vic, who wrote the movie, he told me this afterwards. He goes, you know, Tommy told me, this is what Tommy told him after the film was done. He goes, you know, because it was High Times, I just assumed it was going to be some slap together piece of shit. And I didn't really want to dedicate time to it. It was kind of a take the money and run deal. And had I known that you were involved and the caliber of people that you had pulled in, I would have spent some more time on it. So that was one thing. Tommy was in and out. And I was a producer on the film, but I certainly was not going to start jumping up and down and screaming on the set. That's not my place. I mean, I certainly had the ear of the director, and I encouraged her to make sure that guitar was sold properly on the screen. And she didn't get it either. I said, look, it's only funny if you're playing it and smoking it at the same time. Otherwise, it's just a big guitar-shaped pipe. You know, it's not a guitar bong.
Yeah.
The great thing is, it's fully functional. I mean, that guitar wails. You can bring that on any stage in the world and, you know, forget about smoking dope out of it. It's a real, real, real good guitar. And that's the whole thing, the dingus works. You know, it's a real Rube Goldberg contraption, you know, of a bong.
Yeah.
It's absurd and completely unnecessary.
But to this notion of selling the talent and actually making sure that something like the Chronicaster works and telling the talent that, look, we're trying to make a serious, fun comedy. I mean, surely as a producer, you could have told these people as you were signing up Jason Mewes and Tommy Chong and everybody else that, look, we're putting together a credible film, and we hope that you can actually play ball with this. This isn't just a paycheck, take the money and run scenario.
Well, I'll tell you what, there are way too many cooks in that kitchen when we made that film, and I'm just one of the quote-unquote executive producers, along with Steve Bloom, another one of my former High Times co-workers who kind of poisoned the well, by trying to get people stoned during the day on the set, and just the rampant unprofessionalism that comes connected to like running a dope magazine.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, the director wasn't the right person for it either. God, I hope I don't sound like I'm just bashing freely at everybody, but it really was, I mean, it would have been a comedy of errors had it not been just so pathetic and sad the way the movie resulted. Allison, the director, her experience was working for National Geographic, and she came to the table with a lot of the money already raised for the movie. And Vic, who had, you know, his last credit was Summer of Sam, and he knew what the hell he was doing, and the screenplay was real sharp, but she was not the right person for a pot comedy. She had no connection to the culture, and also wasn't going to lean on Tommy Chong to make this thing work, nor on the tight budget that we have did we have a day to work on the Chronicaster. There was something like, I don't know, 80 speaking parts in a movie that was shot in 30 days, which is, you know, outrageous for, you know, an independent movie with a budget of only $1 million. You know, you look at most movies like that, it's two people sitting in a coffee shop, you know, talking about Madonna.
Yeah.
And this wasn't that. It was a huge ensemble piece and very ambitious, probably too ambitious for what needed to be done. But the screenplay was sharp. And at the end of the day, if Tommy doesn't want to play the guitar, they're going to get the scene done. They're going to move on.
But going back to this notion that you brought up earlier about trying to manage an office at High Times of a drug magazine, and how your own particular reception was not exactly the best among some of the employees. In fact, the marketing, which we alluded to earlier, even accused you of having pornography, so to speak, in your desk. I'm wondering, though, if you had made efforts to reach out to this so-called marketing, which, or why they were so content to pin this upon you. Or, I mean, surely It takes two to tango in any situation like this. I mean, I don't think it's entirely their fault or entirely your fault, but, I mean, did you make any mistakes to get this particular impression?
Well, that's a very anodyne approach to looking at the situation. The guy said proved that there aren't two sides to every situation is the guy who invented the Mobius strip. I assume his name's Mobius. That is a fallacy. Socrates and Aristotle be damned, reach out to her. Man, her karma is ruined forever. I mean, she's just bad news and bad vibes in every direction. Just the wrong person at the wrong time and the wrong job. And I'm sure there's a black cloud over her head right now. God, her poor husband. I feel so bad for anybody who's involved with this woman. And there are people like that. Hey, again, I give full props to Hager when he did write. I mean, I'm the first guy to say it. And Bloom kind of, you know, takes it on the chin, too, when he did something good. The Stony Movie Awards were a brilliant idea. That was his idea. I thought it was great. And I'm also the first guy to say right in the book, I failed. You know, I failed. My management technique, and not that any management technique or the even concept of a management technique would have worked in a place that eschews authority and doesn't trust hierarchies, would have ever been possible. There have been, when I was there, I'd been like the fifth publisher in like 6 years. I mean, it was insane. It was a real merry-go-round up there. But it was really a culture, you know, for the cliche of the mellow marijuanista, and tranquil hippies and the peace-loving, tie-dyed rainbow brotherhood. This was a culture steeped in, like, backstabbing office politics and who was going to climb over whose back to get to be number one. And Hager ran the place as such, you know, as far as doling out bribes of marijuana for people who handed in their stories first and who could be close to him and who would get the perquisites, which are basically centerfold weed and an occasional trip to Jamaica or Amsterdam. And that was the cult of personality and the dictatorship, far from benevolent, that he was creating.
Wanted no part of this kind of petty bribery at all, and this was perhaps steeped throughout the history of the magazine.
This is bullshit. This is complete bullshit. And the magazine did have the founder, Tom Forsaad. I mean, he would fire people, to fire the entire staff. He'd invite them out to a movie and then get to the theater and just fire them. Now, he was off the beam. That guy was admittedly crazy. He founded the magazine, and he was not so much a hippie or a flower power softie as he was a radical. And a smart guy and a good journalist, and he knew about rock and roll. And he was the guy that put the Sex Pistols on the cover of High Times, which a lot of people don't understand, like this real connection between High Times and punk rock, because he embraced it as radical youth culture, and he thought it was going to be the next movement. Of course, by the time Hager and... you know, because his bong crew, 420 cronies, got in there, that was all over. But back to the marketing, which is the pornography I kept in my office. God, it sounds horrible, right?
Yeah.
I got to tell you, I worked in the pornography print industry for a long time. I wrote for Hustler and I wrote for Penthouse, and I was a staffer, but Screw on and off until I eventually became the editor-in-chief. Really, my Abraham Lincoln story, since I started reviewing, like, massage parlors and peep shows before I got the big corner office. I am more aware of gender politics in the office and more absolutely feminist and hardcore in my pro-woman beliefs and very quick to swing fists or defend the rights of anybody. I'm very much a humanist. And not in spite of the fact that I work in pornography, but because of it. Because you got to be real sensitive. When you're working in a really sexually charged atmosphere, such as, you know, a Hustler office or a Penthouse office, of course, you've got to be, you know, careful and courteous, and there are always going to be some ground rules. But we're also mature adults, and I think people who work in the High Times office, a goddamn drug magazine, you know, for Christ's sakes, don't really get to grasp the moral high ground, you know? And she said, well, he's got pornography in his office. And I'll tell you what the pornography was. Exhibit one, a copy of Screw magazine that High Times was featured in. And that was after I'd appeared on Al Goldstein's TV show, Midnight Blue, which was really, really great. I had a great time. We smoked a big fat joint on TV while he ranted and raved about how he was going to fuck Rudolph Giuliani up the ass and this, that, and the other thing. And I thought it was a great moment of civil disobedience and very funny and absolutely perverse, you know, as Al is, but really, really like putting a hard foot right in the crotch of the city government and who was the enemy of marijuana smokers and civil libertarians everywhere. And for this, you would think I would come back to the applause. You think I'd get, you know, both ears in the tail, as they say in bullfighting. I thought it was a good performance, but no, I got called a pig for being in the gutter with Al Goldstein. And again, here are the guys who peddle drugs. The teenagers are, God, does that sound libelous? Magazines for 18 and over only. Here's a magazine that's pushing illegal drugs and saying sex is a bad thing or sexuality is a bad thing. Just to fight about it all the time. So I had this copy of Screw magazine that featured us in it. And on the cover was a cartoon by the artist Steve Marcus. And it was, it looked like Yellow Submarine, just to give you an idea, sort of stylistically, more or less, with apologies to Steve, of a big fat guy smoking a joint with a red, white, and blue flag behind him. It looked like the cover of High Times in 1976. There was nothing pornographic about it. I would never have anything explicitly sexual in my office in plain view. It's not my style, and frankly, I know better. And the other piece of quote-unquote pornography I had in my office was a copy of Penthouse. It was their 30th anniversary, which coincided with our 25th anniversary. And I thought it was very relevant to what we were doing, just sort of checking out some other people who had sort of been working the same side of the street. And the cover of that magazine was white with a gold key on it. I guess that was his idea of going classy, because Playboy was able to do it with the bunny. Not only wasn't it pornographic or prurient, I'm not sure it was a good marketing idea.
Yeah.
And that's what I had in my office. I would never. And yet, you know, this is someone who would stink solo. It's like, oh, you're creating an uncomfortable work environment. And you know that's a lawsuit waiting to happen. Yeah. And everybody's, you know, got the hair on their back goes up, you know, especially the lawyers who run High Times when someone says that, because they have had problems with sexual harassment there. And this is one place where I won't name names. And it's some of the principles that you know about or have read about. But I think that's out of bounds, because I think they got shafted too. And I'm not going to, just because I dislike them, I'm not going to start ringing that bell, you know, to try to take a cheap shot. You know, I'll report on what I see and what I know.
What is the justification for when you will go after someone? Is it this cheap shot notion?
Do you really think I go after people?
Well, I think, you know, calling people and characterizing a lot of these figures as late. I mean, I just feel that sometimes when portraying your own personal history, that sometimes it helps to be constructive. I mean, you know, I mean, that's why I'm asking these questions of like, well, did these folks actually do some really good things? And I'm getting the sense that they did from you. And Hager is still there, actually, right now.
I mean, I'm not sure about that. The reports of his imminent demise are ringing loudly in my ears. He's sort of the Billy Martin of pot. He's been fired and rehired four times. I have no idea what goes on over there. The recent cover of High Times has a porn star on the cover. Something I never would have been allowed to do. Something I probably wouldn't have done. I mean, the truth is, it's the male readership of High Times is, males are 80% of the readership, more. We all knew it was a men's magazine. If you look back at the roots of High Times, when it really was a great magazine, it started in 1974. Al Goldstein actually wrote a column in the magazine. There was a sex column. There were many sexually explicit stories. One of the first issues that I ever saw was a big tit covered in chocolate, a story about aphrodisiacs, and that's what they sold. It was a magazine about hedonism and lifestyle, and that's why, you know, the cocaine, the champagne, and the LSD, you know, flowed right along with the Acapulco Gold.
But if High Times was also predicated on this backstabbing office politics that you were alluding to, I'm wondering.
Well, I didn't say it was predicated on that, but it was really seeped in that culture.
That you encountered this particular factor in the magazine culture.
That shit's like a flesh-eating disease. Once it gets started, it's hard to stop.
Well, I'm wondering then what distinguishes it really from other magazines. I mean, does this account for you bouncing around from magazine to magazine over the years? Just this notion of constant turnover of backstabbing politics?
No, you know, what makes it different than other magazines? Other magazines don't encourage their staff to be impaired. And that's a real thing. I'm very pro-pot. I'm very pro-marijuana. I'm just anti-stoner and anti-slacker. When I got busted for smoking pot when I was in junior high school, and after I got pilloried and put in the stocks and bonds and, you know, and this close to being shipped off to rehab by my square parents, and really just... how mean people were to me after that. It was like really shocking, you know. The vice principal, who, you know, was in his office every other day anyway, and he would say, "But Mike, we don't understand this. You're a merit scholar and you come from a good family. How could you do such a thing? I mean, I'm smoking a doobie, you know, in the morning. I mean, you know, I told him you should come over to my house and see what goes on there. Maybe you'd understand why I came to school stoned every day." But my English teacher just sort of pulled me aside. It was the only kind word any faculty member said to me. And it wasn't per se kind, but with a note of wisdom. He said, "Mike, there's a time and a place for everything." And that was his only comment on the matter. And yeah, you know, I mean, I love smoking pot. I just really pick my spots more and more. You know, when I go to see Bob Dylan in a couple of weeks, yeah, I'm going to get stoned. Sometimes I like to get stoned and play with my Echo machine. Yeah. Those seem like good times. I like to get stoned and go look at the Kandinskys at MoMA. I get stoned and go to the symphony all the time. You know, if I'm out on the beach, sometimes I like to get stoned. I don't get stoned and go to work. You could smoke all goddamn day and you're still at work. You know, no one ever like hurries out in the morning and says, oh shit, I gotta go, I'm gonna be late to party. We got a magazine to get out, and you know, I hate having the same meeting five times. I mean, it's like Groundhog Day over there. I mean, there are things that go on at High Times, and this is no secret that people would be fired for in any other reasonable work environment.
But some people use it to function. I mean, Robert Altman every morning would smoke marijuana before actually going to a film set and actually doing his work.
Yeah, his output's a little spotty, too. And I just want to say, though, that marijuana being the culture of High Times, I absolutely think people should be smoking pot and getting stoned. But like Mr. English teacher said, there's a time and a place for everything.
Okay, but going back to the question that I had asked you earlier about High Times in relation to these other magazines, I mean, is this backstabbing politics, is this a factor why you have bounced around, or is it perhaps your own exuberant personality, or what's the situation here?
I'm not everybody's cup of tea. I ain't no Swiss picnic. I ain't a day at the beach. I know that. And I loved the idea of working at High Times. I was very eager to work there. I really respect the magazine. I loved it. I came up with, you know, the 60s counterculture behind me and grew up with punk rock and rock and roll in the 80s. I think my greatest asset was that I did straddle a couple generations and that I was as conversant in, you know, Jack Kerouac and Lenny Bruce and the Merry Pranksters and Jimi Hendrix as I was in the Sex Pistols and the Ramones and Nirvana and Hunter Thompson and all these sort of tent poles that hold up this alleged counterculture. And I really wanted to bring that magazine back to a level of literacy and wide stream acceptance and cultural relevancy where it had been, where people would be excited to pick up the magazine, not because they were closet horticulturists, but because maybe they, you know, something would be challenge them. One thing I learned is the porn business is you always write up, you never bring the magazine down to the people, you bring the people up to the magazine. I took karate for a long time. There's a saying, you don't drag the belt down to you, you go up to the belt as you graduate it to various levels. And it's very important that you don't write down to people, you don't pander to people. And that seemed to me to be the High Times way, the easiest way to do things. Hey, you know, anybody who says marijuana doesn't have, a negative side effect hasn't been, you know, doing 2 grams per diem for the last 15 years. It absolutely stifles creativity when you're doing it all the time. When you pick your spots, I think it's great. I get great ideas when I smoke pot, and hopefully I'm smart enough to write them down at the time. And sometimes I just like to smoke pot and play my bongos. I mean, how much of a beatnik does that make me sound like? But real bad drug for proofreading.
Yeah. The sense I got reading your book was that it seemed that you were insinuating that Kennedy, Hager, and all of these figures almost had it in for you, and this led to you inevitably being fired from the actual magazine, and you bounced around. You were both, at one point, both publisher and editor, then you were moved to this editorial director. Did they have it in for you? I mean, what accounts for this? Is just, again, I'm wondering if this is endemic to magazine culture or endemic to High Times.
No, the High Times experience is in a cloud of smoke. And I think each magazine is different. I mean, certainly, some of the feedback I get on my book is that people call me and say, oh my God, it's like stoners are the same as everyone else. They're in love with every word they've ever written and can't stand for anything to be cut. And they really enjoy this, the stories about color separation, because it gets into some really weird problems when you have like someone's face, Ozzy Osbourne, for example, as gargoyle-like as he is, next to a bunch of bright green marijuana, you got some problems maintaining, you know, flesh tone and bright green, you know, on the same signature. I like the nuts and bolts of magazine work, but after that, nothing's the same at High Times. Do I think people had it in for me? Michael Kennedy hired me and was generally supportive of me. My position as publisher became untenable very quickly, and yeah, part of it's my personality. I don't doubt that. And I came out with the cannons firing. And if I had a choice to do it again, I probably would have approached it in a more mellow fashion. But then again, these guys had been in a rut. The magazine sales, I mean, the ball had rolled off the table, and he'd hired me very specifically to turn this around. And managers, people who managed me when I was coming up in the business, when I was working for Cherry and High Society and Celebrity Skin, didn't bullshit me. They didn't coddle me. They didn't treat me like a child. They treated me like as an adult. And they said, Mike, this sucks. Mike, get back to work. This is good. But they also never let me feel that I wasn't encouraged, that that things weren't going to be better. The first thing I heard when I got to High Times and I suggested that we should take a look at the magazine and see how we can make it better was told that it's just fucking fine the way it is. And what do you know? And I say it can always be better. Every magazine that you put out should be better than the last one you put out. That just seems to me like common sense. And you run a business not to maintain it, but to grow it. And I hope my next book is better than this book. I hope the next record I make is better than the last record I made. I would hope that my current project has always had grown and benefited from my experience, you know, the last thing I did. Yeah. And like I said, it was like Groundhog Day over there. And they were just recycling it and then and wondering why people, why the consumer wasn't responding anymore.
Yeah. But how do you reconcile this notion of wanting to make something better than your last magazine or your last job or your last book or your last record with this kind of trajectory that goes up and down? I mean, you worked for Soft Drink at Beer at one point.
Yeah, but I didn't lose that job. I quit that job to go to High Times. And I was successful there. And there was no reason. I mean, there was a, probably a point where I was going to make a decision. I was going to stay there and make more of a career out of it. The dough was okay. I liked the business. I liked the beer business and the soft drink business. I learned an awful lot about marketing there. I think there was definitely a tipping point when I clicked and realized all this marketing stuff that I had been learning about soft drinks was applicable to the magazine business. And I wanted to work for a consumer magazine, and I wanted to work for, you know, something a little bit more sexy than a trade magazine for the beer business. But as far as trade magazines go, it was awesome. Hey, Mike, you want to go to Dublin and check out Guinness and do a story? Man, those guys were geniuses. Guinness was this tiny little brand that only men drank in dirty old bars. Now it's like, you know, you go to a bar, it's a chick-friendly beer, and people are listening to U2 and Van Morrison and getting laid. And that wasn't Guinness 15 years ago. They turned it around. That was an object lesson I thought I could take into the business. Because really, a beer costs about the same as a magazine, and it's about based on repeat purchases and brand loyalty and getting to try it and, you know, and really, you know, being badged with it. All these things that I really learned from the soft drinks business. Bouncing around, I left there. I was pursuing another job. I'd been there 2 years. That was good.
Yeah.
I mean, would you want to work at a trade magazine? And that, I mean, you know.
Not my thing, you know, but, you know, it all depends on why there are these 1 or 2 year stints often. I mean, quitting or being fired.
Well, I'm ambitious. I don't want to, like, you know, move forward and or sideways. As long as I'm not moving backwards.
This notion of becoming a professional writer, you describe in the book your days just after you dropped out of Columbia, working as a porn novelist, banging out one a week, and this caused you to become, or to at least have a professional aspect to what you were doing, and suddenly you had to turn out a 180-page book every week. And I'm wondering, though, if given the fact that you ended up burning out eventually, whether this was really the best way for you to become a professional, or working within these particular limitations of how many ways you can describe a particular sex scene or a particular scenario. I mean, they had these books, as you describe in the book, coded for a particular type of interest or fetish and whatnot. So
I'll tell you, man, after that job, I am absolutely qualified to teach a creative writing class at any university in the country. That was a real challenge. To write these books, and you know, it'd be handed to you, and to really come up with a plot and to learn how to plot a book, you know, premise, conflict, and resolution. Like I say, you know, Little Miss Muffet, Silent Tuffet, there's your premise, and along came a spider, and there's your conflict, and scared Miss Muffet away, being the resolution, which is, you know, just English 101. But these books, you could have some real fun with it, because what's going to happen when that spider comes along? I think Miss Muffet's going to blow that spider. That's what I think. Or I think that spider's going to fuck the living bejesus out of Miss Muffet. And then you know what happens? She can't get enough. Because that was always the conflict in those books.
But you did get burned out eventually,
but,
you know.
But again, I said there are a million ways that that could be played around and twirled around. And actually, it was genre writing, now that I think about it. The genres being S&M, the genres being Young Deb, the genre being gay bondage, or nurses, or transvestite books. You'd get burned out, too, if you're, you know, writing, you know, 50,000 words a week. It gets very difficult to recast. You know, he thrust his quivering meat puppet betwixt her moist scissor cake. I mean, how many times are you going to say that?
Yeah.
It's tiresome and it's a grind, but all of a sudden I was unintimidated by writing for length. When I was in college at NYU, the film school there, before I went off the reservation, I couldn't write a 10-page paper about, you know, the myth of the Western or the revisionist noir in today's society, you know, this bullshit they hand out. I mean, I could have that conversation at the bar with you, and if I just wrote down what I said, I'd have 10 pages. But to sit down with the old electric typewriter, which was, you know, the peak of writing instruments back then, I couldn't do it, you know. And also, I thought it was bullshit. you know, which is a problem. You know, it's just like looking at this and knowing it's bullshit and not being able to do it because it's bullshit and then getting hung up on that was really a problem. But I'll tell you, after writing 28 novels and going to Columbia, and the guy said, you know, give me, you know, I need, you know, a 30-page, you know, term paper on whatever, the Enlightenment or existentialism or transcendentalism in American literature in New England, no problem. Because that week, I 2 weeks before, I just written like a 50,000-word masterpiece about busting Susan's cherry.
Yeah, but I'm wondering if that particular experience, burning out on that experience, affected your ability to craft narratives, whether through music or whether through a lengthy essay in some, or were you just essentially, did you learn this idea of writing on autopilot almost?
No. I don't write on autopilot. I mean, I can certainly bang copy when I need to bang it out.
Quite literally in this other case.
Yeah, you know, you know, like, you know, back in those days, like say, no one wanted it good. They wanted it Tuesday. You know, they didn't mind fine writing as long as it didn't slow you down. But I don't write on autopilot. And I think maybe when I realized that I was, and I hopefully am self-aware enough to know that my biggest crime in writing, you know, these fucking suck books, was not against humanity, but against the English language. I mean, it was just getting to the point where my sentences were just such drivel and such garbage. And I knew it, and it was started to drag me down a little bit, so I needed some distance. I'll tell you, hopefully in an analogous story, sitting in a bar in Dallas, Texas, with Klaus from the Dead Kennedys. This was in 1984, after I had been with the band Reagan Youth. I wasn't in the band, just to make that clear. I was sort of like the road manager and the fifth wheel, and Dave, the singer of Reagan Youth, was a close friend and dragged me along to sort of be his minister of propaganda and carnival barker. And like that. And anyway, after the show, we played in front of, I don't know, 5,000-6,000 people at a protest in front of the convention center where Ronald Reagan was being nominated for the second his second term as the Republican convention. And the Dead Kennedys headlined, and it was a great, successful protest. And afterwards, I was sitting in a bar with Klaus, the Dead Kennedys, the bass player. And I had not met him before, and we're talking about music and how much I admired the Dead Kennedys because of all the bands that had been playing in that punk rock circuit, they seemed to be the only ones who had a record collection that went past 1977. Or 1976. They obviously were very influenced by surf music. They had their Link Ray records. They liked the Beach Boys. They liked Elvis Presley. They liked rock and roll. And they liked country music. And that's where I'm coming from. I mean, I love the Sex Pistols. But on that tour, to find someone else who liked Little Richard or Johnny Cash, you know, was not easy.
Yeah.
It was just thrash music 24/7. So we were talking about that. And he said to me, you know, I used to play in bar bands and country bands and blues bands. But the Dead Kennedys have ruined me. I said, I don't get it. You know, it's such a high-level playing. He goes, you'll see. One, you're playing in a thrash band. One day you're going to go back. You're going to try to play in a blues band, and you're just going to want to do it at 110 miles an hour. You're going to want to start in fifth gear, and you want to stay there, and you're not going to be able to suave anything, and you're fucked. And I think that's at the point when he said that, I realized that. He was absolutely right. And I think I realized that later when I was writing these, you know, these blowjob manuals, that it was killing me, and I needed to slow it down and take my time and start choosing my words more carefully and twirling the stories, you know, a little more deftly. Because hopefully I'm a good storyteller and hopefully I know how to twirl a good sentence. But it wasn't happening in those books. It was time, you know, to just walk away, Mike, walk away.
Does this account, I suppose, for the trajectory we've been talking about of you bouncing from one particular place to another? I suppose this is your own way, perhaps self-consciously, of not getting caught in a particular rut or not playing in a thrash band consistently or not playing in a punk band or whatnot.
Well, you know, I'm bored easily. I wanted to stay at High Times. I really thought I was going to park there and stay there for 10 years. Not to be petulant, but had I had my way, if I ran the circus, I would have. But it was very untenable. And just, you know, I don't take it personally. I'm very open about the mistakes I made, but it was also an unwinnable situation. And I posit as proof to that exactly what happened after I left. The next Kager came and went several times. Then they hired a new publisher and editor, tried to take the pot out of the magazines, presumably the boss's edict. That failed miserably. I heard their circulation was down to, you know, 20, 30,000. They were selling ads, you know, at fire sale prices for cash just to make the payroll. And then, you know, they started putting the pot back in the magazine. And, of course, it came back up, but nowhere near the level that I had it at, by the way. I mean, we were claiming 250,000 paid, were not audited, but it was close. I mean, honestly, you know, not audited. You can take that to mean whatever you want, but it wasn't far off the mark. I think they're at about half that right now. And I think that had a lot to do with like trying to make it a bigger tent. There are competitive magazines out there now, pot magazines, that no one seemed to care about because the cockiness at High Times says, we own this category. We own marijuana. And yet there's a magazine called Heads, and they've got deep pockets. They just don't go away, these fuckers. And Cannabis Culture, and I think there's one or two others, and a lot of the newsstands, at least in New York, carry a couple of the British marijuana magazines. And I would say, you know, you got a pizza. And here's a guy, and he's taking away one slice. Well, if your pizza's got 8 slices, that's more than 10%. And on a year, that's an awful lot of money. And your bosses, they're not going to be happy about losing 10% to another magazine. And here comes another magazine. Even if they only try it because they want to try something different 1 month.
Yeah.
You know, this, my strategy is not revolutionary. You take the guy who buys the magazine 2-3 times a year, you try to get him to buy 6 or 8 times a year, right?
Yeah.
You try to keep all the readers that you got and make more at the same time. You try not to lose anybody, but you try to, you know, get more people into the party. This is, you know, this isn't, you know, a publishing revolution. It's all very common sense. But the cockiness up there said, well, fuck those guys. We own this. I'd say, well, you got two choices. Either you're going to have to make your magazine so goddamn good that no one would ever consider picking it up. And also you're taking the chance that they might pick up their magazine and like it. And sometimes people buy more than one magazine. I know that from the porn business. People buy a primary magazine, and when they're done, you know, quote unquote, using it, they go out and pick out another magazine. Or you got to make that pizza a lot fucking bigger.
Yeah. You've written in this book, and you talked in this conversation about Al Goldstein. But in the book, you point out many of his self-sabotaging moments that affected Screw and affected his particular life. But I must ask you, perhaps in some sense, does self-sabotage work to, I guess, push the limits further in any particular magazine or publication or whatnot? Or?
First, let me say this. Oy fucking vey. And now I'll tell you that Al was very proud that the magazine was a success, not because of him, but in spite of him. I think not caring and not doing everything on some premeditated schedule, there's a lot to be said for that. I think my adventure works as it does because it wasn't premeditated. I wasn't looking to working for a porn magazine. I wasn't even looking for working for a wrestling magazine. But it seemed very logical and natural and a natural progression. I mean, I always wanted to be a writer and I always wanted to play music. And I'm a real happy cat because that's what I do all the time now. So I'm a very happy guy. But if you told me when I was a teenager that I was going to be writing penthouse letters or smoking the High Times centerfold weed or feuding with Hulk Hogan or getting drunk with Evel Knievel, I just would have laughed at you. I mean, my biggest ambition when I was 8 was to be an astronaut or the relief pitcher of the Yankees. And I guess when I got to school, I wanted to make movies and I sort of drifted into becoming a writer. But the thing is, if you're, you know, let me quote Bill Hicks here. If you're living for tomorrow, you'll always be a day behind.
Yeah, yeah. Or, you know, to quote, it depends on who you believe, if whether it was actually John Lennon, life is what happens when you make other plans, which I know you particularly loathe those guys. But, I mean, I must also ask you, what are your thoughts on John Lennon's Plastic Ono Band? That is undisputably rock and roll and punk, I would argue.
Hey, I love the Plastic Ono run record. Well, it's just awesome. And, tell you what I was thinking about John Lennon. I was watching actually the making of that record on VH1 Classics the other night. The production's great, and you know the Primal Scream therapy and that whole thing sort of worked. And how about Ringo? You know, here they are, you know, people who slag Ringo all the time as some, you know, guy who can't play the drums or like minimally talented. And the Beatles break up, and who's the first guy they call to play the drums?
Yeah,
right. I mean, he was on all of their other solo records, right?
Yeah.
The first guy. These guys could have gotten anybody. Bernard Purdy, arguably the finest drummer of his generation, you know, had like been around that scene. They could have gotten anybody, and they called Ringo. All right? So there's my defense of Ringo Starr. And also the No-No song, the best thing ever done by any Beatle. I was watching them record Instant Karma, and it sounds so great. It's got the big Phil Spector sound and that incredible slapback on the voice and the huge sounding drums. And the cool thing was about that, too, is they recorded it one day and it was like on the street like a week later.
Yeah.
It was instant karma.
Yeah.
And that's really cool because the whole machine of the music industry would never tolerate that from a major act.
Yeah.
That only happens, you know, in the gutters of, you know, MySpace these days.
Yeah.
But there was Yoko Ono sitting in the back with her eyes blindfolded and her mouth gagged, holding up a sign that says Hope. And I'll tell you, I love Dada. I'm for the Fluxus art movement. I love it. I mean, she did some really good stuff. She's, you know, really, really a great artist in some regards. Had some really great ideas. Did not belong not only on that set, but certainly not caterwauling behind Chuck Berry on the Mike Douglas show. You know, so
yeah, no
so,
shit.
So there are some real lapses in judgment on John's part.
But you know, I would argue that.
And by the way, they didn't end the Vietnam War either. Yeah. Hey, look, not everything they ever did is a catastrophe. But you know, as I posit in my book, for every Taxman or Your Blues or, you know, for every Helter Skelter, there's obla di obla da. You know, Hey Jude is kind of the most boring fucking thing I've ever heard. It sounds like a retard practicing the piano. And John Lennon, too, imagine, you know, another piano lesson gone awry. But Instant Karma's, you know, a motherfucker. It's a beast, you know? And then again, for every well, there's going to be another, there's got to be a Silly Love Songs.
Okay, fair enough. But I mean, going back to
where I like Ringo Starr's output. I like My Boogie Shoes, I like that. I like Photograph.
Ringo Starr's output, even that shitty first album where he said, I did this for my mom.
All I want is a photograph. That's a good song.
Oh, God.
That's a good song. I put that up to next to anything Steve Miller ever did.
Fair enough. But going back to the idea we were talking before we were talking about the Beatles, and that is this idea of
goddamn
not,
sacred cows.
Well, not being able to really predict where we're going to go in life. I mean, is this really what it is? Your life and anyone's life should really be this state of anarchy of constantly not planning here.
I'm in no position to say what anybody's life,
or your life.
Should
Let's talk
be.
About, I mean, you know,
I
this,
could only
this
speak for myself
here.
And, you know, offer some friendly sharky advice to anybody who gives a good goddamn, but I'm in the moment, you know, and I like it. And I've got a great job right now. I get up, I go to work, and I work for a book publisher called Backbeat Books, and we do wonderful books. We do the official punk rock book of lists, and I'm working on a Sly Stone biography, and I've got this great book called coming out in the fall. Called I Hate New Music, the Classic Rock Manifesto, and we're doing a book with Levon Helm, and there's so many good projects that we're doing. This is what I do during the day. So I'm very happy, and I'm not, you know, running around getting wasted. I'd like to stay there for a long time. But who knows? I might wake up next week and be struck by lightning. I might get hit by a car. And I might metaphorically get hit by a car and realize I got to run off to the desert and write a symphony. And a lot of things I gotta do in my life. I've got a Broadway musical I need to write. I've got to become an abstract expressionist painter. I got to open a jazz bar in Costa Rica, and I still haven't been on the vomit comet. You know, I need to experience weightlessness. Unfortunately, I pitched my publisher on the idea of shooting a video for my book on that damn thing, but it cost $3,000 for 30 seconds, and they balked.
Wow, fantastic. Well, Mike, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thanks a lot. Ending on the vomit comet. This seems absolutely apropos.
Well, I hope I see you there. Thank you very much.